you're Rajanath, then ask his next question. In this verse, it is said that the Vedas are the only evidence, and direct perception, along with the other sources of evidence, should be accepted only to help in understanding the Vedas. However, Nyaya, Shankhya, and the other philosophies are also sources of evidence. The Puranas, direct perception, inference, comparison, the Vedas, the Vedic histories, itihas, understanding something by its absence, anupalabdhi, circumstantial evidence, artapati, and probability, sambhava, are all considered different sources of evidence. Why should it be considered that some kinds of evidence are more valuable than others? If direct perception and inference are not considered sources of evidence, then what kind of knowledge will one be able to get? Please explain this so I may understand. See, he's given here what? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, yeah, 10. So he's basically given about 10 or so evidences. There's something like that, 10 kinds of evidence. And so then these are seen, but now the real evidence is the Vedas, is authority. That's the main. His perception or other inferences and all this then may have some problems. So his point is, why is one considered better than the other? Like that. So if direct perception and inference are not sources of evidence, so what kind of knowledge will you be able to get? Because you read from the Shastra, you have to be able to apply it. And if you can't apply it, then you won't get realization. So what will you get from this if you aren't able to do this? So that's the point he's making, you know. But he's not seeing it in terms of the Vedas. We use direct perception, but only in terms of the Vedas. The Vedas say something, and then we go out and we see it, so we directly perceive it. And then understanding from there, then actually it comes perfectly to us. So therefore it's important that direct perception is part of the process, but only as a support or in pursuance of what the Vedas say. That's an important element like that. So But Rajanath is not seeing that. He's just seeing that you get something from direct inference. You get from this, you get from that. In other words, all these are sources of your evidence, and all these are how you put together your knowledge. Right? Not that the Veda is the first, and the other nine are subservient to that. If they don't give the conclusion that the Vedas have given, then its evidence is not correct. It's not to be accepted. He's taking it that all are forms, they're all equal. So then Babaji Maharaj will reply. Babaji, direct perception and other sources of evidence, all depend on the material senses. Material senses of the conditioned soul are subject to four defects. Brahma, mistakes. 2, pramada, illusions. 3, vipralipsa, cheating. And 4, karnapatava, sensory inefficiency. How can one attain true knowledge with such faulty instruments? The Supreme Personality of Godhead himself appeared in the hearts of the great saints and sages as they were wrapped in meditation upon him. The Lord gave them the perfect knowledge that is the Vedas. Therefore, without fear, one can accept the Vedas as truth. Yeah. So because we see here is these ones are there, is okay, the Puranas are also Vedic. The Vedic histories, itihas, the Vedas, those are all based on the Vedas. But now perception, inference, comparison, understanding something by its absence, circumstantial evidence, probability, then all those are dependent upon us, our intelligence, our senses. So now if we make a mistake, that will not show up in the calculation. Cheating, because of illusions. We have illusions, so we don't see things properly. Or we see it properly, but we don't want to accept it. Or then the last is sensory inefficiency, so we haven't even seen it properly in the first place. Right? So because of that, then these problems come up. So Therefore, you can't have proper knowledge based on the senses because of these four problems. But the Lord, then he himself has given the scriptures. He's infallible. He appears in the hearts of the great sages, and who are you know, absorbed in meditation upon him. And so then he gives them the perfect knowledge. Therefore, then that knowledge is the Vedic knowledge, like that. So we see the Vedic knowledge is always connected with some great personalities and discussions amongst them. That's basically what they all are. Everything actually is conversations and stories, like that. Rajanath, please explain these four defects: mistakes, illusions, cheating, and sensory inefficiency. Babaji, when the imperfect material senses make mistakes in perceiving the world around it, that is called Brahma. Okay. So that explains what was the first one? Mistakes. Mistakes, then, are when the imperfect material senses make a mistake in what they're perceiving. That's Brahma. Seeing a mirage in the desert is an example of such a mistake. The intelligence of the conditioned souls is limited. Therefore, when such a limited intelligence tries to understand the unlimited supreme, the limited intelligence is bound to be illusioned in many ways. That is called pramada. Okay, pramada is illusions. Okay. The intelligence of... Okay, when you're trying to apply something limited on something unlimited, then there's going to be illusion. This is the problem. People think they're very intelligent, so by their little brain, they're going to understand God, who is unlimited. You know, they say, how do you understand what? You say, okay, so God's the source of everything. Who's the source? The source of God. No, the definition of God is the one who's the source of everything. No, but where does he come from? But you can't answer that because the brain isn't big enough. You can't stick that in, you know. So therefore they can't. So there'll be illusions. Example of this is seen when the material intelligence, limited by time and space, questions how the Supreme Person could have created a material world of time and space. Doubt is called vipalipsa. The material senses are not very efficient tools for acquiring knowledge. Vipralipsa is cheating. Okay. Doubt is called vipralipsa. Okay, so that's cheating. When you doubt something, then you don't act properly. You doubt it, so therefore you'll do something else. Like someone says, you know, smoking is bad for you. You doubt it, so therefore you still smoke. It's cheating, because you know. You doubt it, so therefore you avoid the evidence. Even though it's counted as evidence, but you ignore it. Sensory is you can't tell what it is, you make a mistake in it. Or you see something there that's not there. You have an idea, what you want, and so you'll see that. It's not there, like a mirage. You want to see water, and so you see it. Or you've seen something else, you see this here, and then you connect them, and then you think that's there. So the one is you can't see it properly. The other one is you see things you want to see, even though they're not there. The other thing is they're there, but you don't see them. Right? Does that make sense? Okay. And then the fourth one, material senses are not very efficient tools for acquiring knowledge. When they make mistakes again and again, that is called karna patava. So the senses that we're working with, they are defective, so they can't see everything. So right there we're starting with faulty tools. Right? So just what we're working with. And then the other three is because of the conditioned nature. Right? Is that what's there we can't perceive it properly, perceive things that aren't there, or what's there, we ignore them because we doubt that that's the proper understanding. So this all comes because of conditioned nature. Rajanath, do not sensory perception and other sources of knowledge have any value at all? Babaji, Is there a way to understand the material world except with the material senses and other like sources of knowledge? Still, all these sources of knowledge are powerless to understand the spiritual world. For the spiritual world, the Vedas are the only source of knowledge. If sense perception and these other sources of evidence confirm the truths revealed in the Vedas, then the knowledge and other life sources of knowledge may be accepted only when they confirm the teachings of the self-perfect Vedas. So in this material world, you only perceive things or deal things through the senses. The soul is in the body, right? So that's dead matter, and the soul is there. So it's like being inside a dark room, you know, with no windows, no doors, or anything like that. So you only know what's outside through the doors and windows. Like, we're in this room, so we can see what's outside this, looking through this door, out there, out here, like that. So like that, the senses are there. That's how we perceive what's outside. We generally think, no, I'm just seeing everything, but we're seeing that only through the eyes, or hearing only through the ears, or smelling through the nose, tasting through the mouth. So we're so used to it, we just think it's perfectly, you know, very complete. You know, we forget we only see what's in front, we don't see what's behind. You know, we can only hear things that are certain, you know, smell things that are within proximity. You know, we can't smell those trees over there. Like that. So, like that, we're limited. So we only know the world through the senses. So he's pointing out, you only know the world through the senses. But the spiritual world, we can't know through the senses, because it's not here. It's not in this world, it's in another place. So that you can only know through the Vedas. And then, since that spiritual topic is what we're interested in, then also of this world, since this material world has been created by the Supreme Lord and is run according to the Supreme Lord's direction, so therefore you can only know this world really through the Vedas also. Because it doesn't stand independently from the spiritual world. It's dependent upon the spiritual world for its existence. So then, it means the Supreme Lord and His energies, they run this world. So then the sense perception is valuable if it confirms what the Vedas say. If it doesn't confirm, then it's of no value. And someone may say, well, no, it's a value. I thought it. So what? The little kid picks up some stone and he says, this is of great value, but he can't go to the store and buy anything. But the kid values it. So what? Who cares? You know? Who cares? So in the same way as who cares about somebody's speculation? They have some speculation. Who cares? But because they're proud of it, then they think the world should care. Because they're, you know, a big kid, right? If they're little kids, then... you know, nobody cares. But if they're big kids, then you have to listen. But in reality, it doesn't matter. So if it doesn't confirm the teachings of the Vedas, then it's useless. It doesn't really do anything like that. Yeah, means you can ask at any time.
It's confirming the Vedas by sense perception. Isn't there a risk with that also, that sometimes your sense perception may be wrong, and still it can confirm the Vedas, and then you proclaim that this sense perception is confirm the Vedas, but you have done a faulty conclusion because your sense perception was wrong, and then when someone pointed it out, you appear like a fool because you are trying to confirm the Vedas something faulty.
Yeah, but then that confirms what the Vedas say.
Because
the conditioned soul has these four defects.
But that's not the easier at stake.
No, the point is here, what he's meaning by this, I don't know if it will be explained later on, but the point is you hear that this world is a place of misery. Okay, so you've heard that, but that's theory. Right? But when you go out and you look around you and you see suffering, and you observe in yourself suffering,
due to the material engagements. That confirms it for you. That will give realization. So, therefore, coming to the point of pratyaksha, or direct perception, that is what you want. But pratyaksha, is that long enough? Oh, that's the getting on. Pratyaksha is only useful if it is in support of the Vedas. So, because realization comes by thought, contemplation, and activity. You can't get realization without both. The thought can be very simple, just on the basic principle. So, but both have to be there. Realization only comes when you combine both. You know?
Contemplation and action.
Yeah. Means the karmi gets no realization because he acts. The jnani gets no realization because he doesn't work. Only the devotee gets realization because he does both at once. So that means then it has to be done in devotion. Right? Because it's connected with the Supreme Lord. So actually what's happening, realization only comes to the devotees. You know? It means real valuable. It means you can get some certain material benefits, like you can talk to people of this world, and they can tell you so many realizations that they've had in this world, you know, in life and like that. You know, you speak to an old man, they can tell you, you know, listen, son, you know, this is what's the way I wish. And they have a great, but it's only in this material world. So they can tell you how to deal in the material sphere, because they've thought about it and they've acted on it, but still it's only material. But only when it's connected to the Vedas does it give proper benefit. We can get that. They've gotten, you know, some understanding, but how will that save them?
Well, yeah, I think that's the point. It is beneficial to us to be guided by the Vedas in our perception.
Yeah. No, it's beneficial for us to perceive what has been given by the Vedas. You understand? It's the other way around. Both elements are there, but it has to start from the Vedas. You know? Of course, if we already have some experience, and then we read the Vedas, and then think, oh, that's what this is. But see, it only gets useful when you connect it to the Lord. If it's not connected to the Lord, it doesn't have any use. You know, we can say, oh, so much use is there, you know, we've made the cars and the airplanes and this, but what's the use if it's not connected to the Lord? Nothing is of use, not even for a devotee. Devotee, they do this, that, they get money, they get so many things, what's the use if it's not connected to Krishna? It has no use for them. They may think it's use, but that's, you know, this illusion. Because they see something there, they see some value, some happiness in something that's not there, it doesn't have any happiness. Right? Or they see it what is that? Or they have some doubt. Krishna consciousness can give everything. No, the Krishna consciousness can't. Krishna consciousness is nice philosophy and has some good things like this. But, you know, in the real world, then, you know, this is a very common statement. But that's illusion. That's doubt. That's cheating. Because the point is, where does the concept of money come from? Why do we call this shelter? A bird doesn't call this shelter. It calls that green thing out there shelter. You know, and a bug doesn't call it, they call that hole over there shelter. But the concept of shelter has come from where? From God. And for humans, it's this. Humans have always lived in things like this. Yeah? Because it's set by God. The standards are set by God. That's the point. God sets the standards. God sets the standards of food. God sets the dress and everything like this. Where does the concept of marriage come in? Why is it a sacrament? Why does every religion have it? You know, why is it considered something sacred? You know, what are these things that you shouldn't steal? you shouldn't kill, you shouldn't... These are all... Every place has it. Where do these come from? You know? Money. How does money work? That there's such a thing as money. Why money? You know? Why some people are into money, some are not. You should have some cultures that don't work on money. Every culture works on money. There's something of value to them that they can trade in. They may have different things, like there's this. Some African tribes, it's cows, some it's pots, clay pots. A rich man has a house full of pots, like that. That's considered wealth. He's very wealthy, he has so many pots. Whether they got anything in the pots, that's another thing, but he has pots. So they consider very, but these concepts have come from God. So that's the whole thing. So there's an illusion to think that, you know, that there's something outside of what God's given. So to say Krishna consciousness has part and then there's the real world, that means then you're saying there's God and then there's something outside of God. Right? But that's a non-Vedic conception. You can have God, you can have Satan, who works outside of God. But in the Vedas, there's no such thing as Satan. There cannot be a Satan. Who can work outside of God? It could be Maya, but Maya works in conjunction with God. So this idea that you can have God and something separate, this is not a Vedic conception. It's a Western illusion. So, therefore, the whole basis on which they're even claiming these things are illusion, mistaken perceptions, and basically the main thing is cheating. Because they have their own ideas, and they're not acknowledging the Vedas. The Vedas get into everything. You want to know how to clear your nose out, your sinuses. The West doesn't have anything to do for that, but the Vedas does. The yoga has so many things. How you can clean your sinuses. And, right? Like that. So much is there. So that's the point, is that there is nothing outside the Vedas. You don't have anything outside the Vedas. That's the principle. So therefore, the perception, everything that is connected to the Vedas, it has a use. Otherwise, there's millions of people out there that are elderly, have been through the whole grihastha scene, they're retired. They can tell you so much how to run a family, what's valuable, what's not, this and that. But what's the use? They're going to die and possibly become all kinds of, who knows what species of life. So even though they have knowledge, they have a seeming realization, what is the value of that? How will it save them? How will it actually benefit the soul? It doesn't.
Because it's disconnected from the Vedas.
As soon as you connect that to them, it's very valuable. Right? There's so many things that the karmis know that even devotees can take advantage of. So much experience, so much this, so much that. But it's only of use if you can connect it to the Vedas. Otherwise, the devotees just take it straight and try to apply it, it does not work. Devotees take these big management books and that. You know, Kavi was a big thing, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 years ago. Everybody was talking Kavi. Everything's this quadrant, that quadrant, this, you know, principle, that principle. Where is it? I haven't seen any management happen since they've been talking about it. I haven't seen the management improve at all. Unless you're connected to Krishna, it won't work. Because this is Krishna's movement. It's Krishna's material world. It's working for those people simply the results of their karmic activities. Because previously they acted according to the Vedic principle. Therefore they have the result now that they're getting good results. But if you try to see that good result separately from the Vedas, then it's only artha. Artha comes from dharma. Artha does not come straight on its own. You see, you know, man A is successful. You just look at what he does and then do what he does. You will not be successful. Because he's successful, he's got artha because of dharma. And if you look at his artha and try to figure out the mechanics of his artha and try to apply it, you won't get artha. Unless you've done some dharma in the past that you'll get that result. You deserve that result from your dharma that you've done before. Otherwise, why is it one man applies it, it's great, another man applies it, it's useless? Right? One man goes to one doctor and tries something, it doesn't work. Another one goes there and it saves his life. Simply, it's not the activity you're doing, it's what you've done before and the result that you're supposed to get. It comes through that, so there's an overlap. The activity you do today and the result that you get from yesterday, they overlap. So it looks like the activity today is giving the result, but it's not. It's a medium through which the previous results are gotten. I went to the doctor, I got cured. No, you got cured because you're in previous results, you're supposed to be cured.
You're supposed to go to the right doctor.
Yeah, that's all. Otherwise, then you won't. People go to 10 doctors for the last 20 years, no results. And finally they go to one doctor, and then it goes away, the disease. Ah, this guy made it go away. But there's plenty of other devotees that say that that doctor's useless. Because that's the first doctor they went to. And they'll go, after their 20 years, they'll go to the doctor that the other guy went to first and get cured by him. Point is, you're supposed to be sick for 20 years. Then after 20 years, you're going to be free from the disease. Us. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So that's the whole thing. Because of this overlap, because activity is important. Laziness is not. Religion doesn't work on laziness. It works on activity. You have to be active, you have to be active with the body, with the mind, the intelligence. You know, these have to be actively engaged in the Lord's service. So therefore, since we don't know God, we have to be active in the rules given by God, which means given in the Vedas. So activity is important. The sitting down and doing nothing, and that's religion, is not a religion. It doesn't function. It's not an option. Right? We may say, well, the yogis sit down. Yeah, but after what? When the yogi sits down and does nothing, he's already on the liberated platform. Right? Means the first six stages of yoga are done to get you to the liberated platform. The seventh and eighth, jhana and samadhi, they're liberated. They're not on the they're not conditioned anymore. So during the first six, they're very active. So there's no such thing as sitting down and doing nothing. There's no religion that has sit down and do nothing. It doesn't exist. So because in the spiritual world, no one sits down and does nothing.
Is the activity important for this combination with knowledge, realization? Is that
religion?
Yeah. Religious karma?
No, see, religion can give you liberation if it's done in a detached way. If it's done in an attached way, it gives you art and karma. If it's done in a detached way, it gives you liberation. But that's the limit of the material activities. If you perform the religious activities for a result, then you get art and karma. Yeah, material result. And if you do it in a detached way, then it will give you liberation.
Then how do we understand that yogis have come into meditation and they have become detached from the world? They may take birth, but they are becoming very attached. You know, they may go to the nirvana and come down again.
Well, that's because they come back. Because they're starting over again. They start over again. I mean, that's not due to the result of what they've done now. That is due to they become liberated, and then because the soul can't be in an inactive state. Therefore, when they want to become active, their only experience of activity is the material world. They don't know the spiritual world, so they come back. But they'll start off in a liberated condition. It means they'll be in a pure condition. And then gradually they'll get, you know, more and more engrossed. You understand? It means they'll start off in a sattvic kind of platform. And then slowly get more engrossed. Like the living entities, when they first come into the material existence, they come in as Lord Brahma. So that's the highest platform you can be at. So theoretically, from there, you could figure out this is crazy and go back to Godhead. but, you know, by evidence of what's around here, plenty of living entities don't do that. So then from Brahma, then they come down as Prajapatis, then as sages, and then as this, until they get down to Indugopa germs. You know, and then they start up again until they get up to the, you know, Brahma again. And they just keep going around and around in circles. So we're here, you know. So that's separate, like that. That's just, that just proves that the living entity has to be active. And the only real liberation is liberated from material existence and being established in spiritual existence. That's real liberation. So devotional service to the Lord, that's liberation. That's real liberation. No, they have to. They have duties, but they're not compelled to act for artha and karma. Their dharma is for liberation. That's why I said they give up the activities that create, you know, create result. So, on the material platform, then that means they give up any activity of the material world that creates economic development. And so therefore then they're not really so active. So they get jnana, but generally, technically, they don't really get liberation. Like that. It means they could theoretically, but generally we see they don't. So, but the devotee giving that up means you give up doing the activity for yourself. And you do it for the Supreme Lord. So therefore it may give the material result of artha and kama. But it's not artha and kama for you. It's for the Lord. That's where it's opposite. That's why bhakti is not understood by the karmis or the jnanis. To the karmis, we're giving up the pleasures of this world. For the jnanis, we're engaged in activities of this world. So neither of them can understand how it's spiritual. Like that. Neither can understand. It's in its own category. Because you're doing the activity in a detached way, so it takes you out of the material world, but you're doing the activity. So that's the thing. That's why they can't understand it. If you want to be liberated from this world, then their idea is sannyas. So grihastha can't be liberated. Right? It's a stepping stone. You fulfilled your desires, so therefore you're satisfied, then you can renounce the world. But the devotee, as a grihastha, then they are engaged in serving the Lord. And so their activities are for the Lord, the house is for the Lord, everything they have is for the Lord. So technically they're sannyasis. But they're using the medium of the grihastha ashram for that service. But the reason they're using, so one can say therefore there's no difference. Technically there's no difference. But there is a difference because one is using the grihastha ashram generally because of his own material desires, his own conditionings. So he can't not use it. Right? The acharyas come and show us how to do this. Right? Bhakti Vinod Thakura Prabhupada shows us as grihasthas how to engage, but they don't have a need. They're just performing the duties. They're just performing those duties. To show us example of what should be done.
Means
in the material world. Like that. For the devotee, if they're satisfied, they think that's it, then it's not fully beneficial.
So what about, like, what Yogi told me once, that it's not good to acquire too much knowledge which we cannot, like, things which we cannot follow, rules, like someone who comes from Western culture trying to apply some, like, Dominican culture, something. So she told me, like, better don't get too much into it, because if you cannot follow, you get reaction.
That's there. That's there. What you know, you're obliged to. So therefore, you shouldn't study so much things that you're not going to follow. You know, it's disrespectful to the scripture also. You read it because you want to follow what it's saying.
So even if you have desire, but cannot because of conditioned nature, still reaction.
What you know about, it means if you don't know about it, then you're not really liable for it. If you're within what your spiritual master has given you, and you follow that, then that's fine. But if you expand that knowledge, then what you expand it, then you're liable for. Right? Because otherwise you weren't asked to read those things. You've read them on your own. So now it's told you more rules, so then you should be following. Otherwise, don't read them. You know? Does that make sense? Like that. It's just like, you know, let's say you have 2 children, you can maintain that. You decide to have 10. And if you can't maintain that, then that means, then, but you're liable to maintain them. If you don't, then you'll get the reaction. Does that make sense? Okay. But at the same time, it shouldn't be then thought that because we're conditioned, we're Westerners, and we can't follow all those things, then by us not following them, it's as good as someone who does follow them. Right? There should be a difference made there. It should create humility. That because we're fallen, we can't do all these things, so I'm humble. But if we're proud and or even think we're better than all these other guys, ritualistic and all this, we don't care for that. It's Kali Yuga, who can follow that anyway. It's kind of like, you know, speak for yourself, white man. You know, it's like Indians are able to follow it. You know, that's it. There's all these rules and regulations that we have to follow that are considered very tough, difficult social things. There's millions of people who are following quite easily. You know? It's just normal for them. And it's not a big deal. So therefore, there has to be a balance there. Is if one says, we can't follow all those things and it's too much and we have enough to do this, stick to this, do your best with that because that's what Prabhupada's given, then that's good. That's good. You know, so don't go outside of this because we may not be able to follow. That's good. But if it's like Prabhupada's given this, but even that's too much, and no one can follow it anyway, so everybody, anyone who does is a fanatic, that's not honest. That's cheating. Because you have a doubt. But Prabhupada's given. Prabhupada has watched the Westerners, then established the rules of this time. So he's established, can be followed. He wouldn't have established things that cannot be followed. They can be followed. Like that. If they say they can't be followed, then they're saying that we're more intelligent than Papa. They can be followed. So you just have to distinguish between these two. They're saying if what Prabhupada gave is enough, follow that, don't bother with more, because as Westerners it's going to be very difficult. Then that's good, that's honest. But if they're going to say that what Prabhupada's given can't be followed, or doesn't apply, or Prabhupada made it up, it's not there in the Vedas, that's all cheating. That's all illusion. That's all mistake. That's all conditioned nature. That's just nonsense. It means to come across it means by your own study and all that. That's one thing. Then why studies? You know what I'm saying? It
means if you,
yeah, but then what's the Western saying? Curiosity killed what?
Killed what?
Curiosity killed the cat. Oh, you don't know that one? That's an English saying. Curiosity killed the cat. So Point is what's the need? Of what service is it? You know what I'm saying? It means we serve the Shastra by surrendering to it and then studying it. Or just to read it for interest or fun. Then that means that's jigyasu, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So then we're just trying to get some, you know, it's just some interesting knowledge. So it won't give us any realization. So then what's the real benefit? You know? Of course, if everybody's reading and talking about it, we'd rather have first-hand experience so we know what's there. That's another thing, because then we're trying to understand what's proper, because people are saying, everybody's quoting this one book and they all say it in a different way and it sounds different than what Prabhupada is stressing or giving it, so then when they read it in themselves they get a proper understanding so they won't be bewildered, or approach someone who has a good understanding and ask them. You know, something. It's something you just have to be careful about. It means what we read, we should be, but we have to know what's the purpose of them. That's also, if we want to read Hari Bhakti Vilas, then we should understand the principles of the deity worship, so we know what applies to us under what circumstances. What's the principle behind it? Right? Understand? You eventually look, it's all cleanliness and respect. You know? All these main qualities, you know, these basic qualities, these are what's there. Service, cleanliness, respect, these different things. So, therefore, then there's so many things given of respect. How to respect, you know, how to see Krishna's potency in so many places. You know? How to see cleanliness connected with everything. Like that. So therefore then, cleanliness of the mind, cleanliness of the body, cleanliness of the words, how that's all done. And so then it's giving us finer and finer detail. The principles Prabhupada gave, so therefore we can understand these principles, so then stick to that. But if you can't see that, then you get bewildered. So that's why you have to be very careful when you go into these other scriptures.
In which way are we obligated? Like, what kind of sanction comes to us if we don't follow such things that we came across?
Let us say you have a friend and that friend has a problem. Okay, now that friend, because they figure it's their personal problem, they're not getting you involved. Right? But if either by other means or through them, you pry into this problem, and now you know about this problem, because they're your close friend, now do you have an obligation to help them with this or not? Right? If you know about all this, what do you say? But
it may not be,
but it was within your sphere of influence to pry into something that the person wasn't going to involve you in.
What if you came across through someone like you just happened to hear about it?
Yeah, but that's another thing. But how did you just happen to hear about, you know, seven chapters of Hari Bhakti Vilas? You heard that there were seven chapters, but now they just suddenly jumped there in front of you and forced you against the wall and the pages turned and your eyes were focused on them, and you know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying?
So in which way, what kind of sanction are we going to get?
You shouldn't worry about, that's not the point. The sanction is not, that's the last stage. You don't do this, you go to hell. It's the last final thing. You know, the point is that these different rules are there to please Krishna. And so then, therefore, if our duty is to please Krishna, if we know that these please Krishna, then we should follow them. Right? But we have to understand how they please Krishna through our authorities, you know, through the scriptures and the directions given by our authorities, by the acharyas. Then that's the way it has to be applied. Like, means whatever it is, all application must go back to this Guru Sadhana Shastra. So we have to see, how does it apply? So if we're really worried, then we ask. We ask, okay, these rules are there. How does that apply in my life? Maybe that applies in this way or that way, or it's simply an understanding. Or some of them, they don't apply at all. You know, like there's, you know, probably many rules on if you're going to, you know, pass urine out in the field. But if you use bathrooms, none of them apply at all. You know, so then you have to, you know what I'm saying? So you inquire and find out how it applies to you, what is the purpose that it's given. You know, like that. But in other words, you want to read these things, then you should be willing to follow. You know, you want to read Vishwanath Chakravarti's book, so like here, we're reading this book, then we should be willing to practice what he's giving. If we don't want to practice this, then we shouldn't come to the class. Right? You know, it's like we give a class in Bhagavad Gita, then we should be willing to understand and find out what is this Gita talking about. Like that. And if we don't want to apply it, then why come to the Gita class? Otherwise we gain knowledge, but then we're not able to apply it and get realization. Without the realization, then we don't progress. Right? And devotees get realization because that practice and contemplation is done in devotion. That's why Krishna says, perform the activity in knowledge for me. Right? If it's done, and if it's done in knowledge, that means you know what's going on. You're doing the activity, so then that means then that whole secondary process of manana is in place. Right? Then he says, for me, that means it's done in a detached way, so it will take you towards liberation, not towards artha and kama. Then, in devotion, means it's being doing for bhakti, because otherwise the impersonalist can also perform the activity in knowledge for Krishna, but his desire is liberation. Right? For Krishna just means it's not for me. You know, it's God's result. God's activity according to his directions for his result. But because it's done in devotion, then it becomes, the whole process becomes part of bhakti. So then the karma, the jnana get engaged in the devotional process. So all those must be there. The activity, the knowledge, the detachment, and the devotion. So those four must be there. Then you're combining, if it's a knowledge and a practice, right? Then that's the Sandini potency. And if it's done with detachment, then it's uplifting rather than entangling. Right? Then it's done with devotion, that's Hladini. Right? When you combine Hladini and Sambit, then that is bhakti. Right? So then Sandini will give realization. Because realization comes from Sandini. Okay, so that's the process. That's why there must be the combination, otherwise it doesn't work. The sambit means the knowledge and the activity. It means both. Otherwise you do one or the other and sambit's not complete. You know, and if it's only sambit, how far it can get you? Maximum it can give you is liberation. Or, you know, or paramatma realization, which basically means liberation. Is that okay? Anything else?
I'm not telling you about this. If you want to sometimes they take literature from outside and they are telling they are flying, but there is no result. After some time you see that nothing's happening, maybe I don't think. So what
then
means to dovetail something
in
Krishna's service?
Yeah, let's say dovetail means you have to see how it dovetails.
If they do wrong, the motivation is not right?
No, it means, probably means that the dovetailing wasn't done so well. But the dovetailing must have done so. They didn't take it far enough, that's all. Because if you contemplate it enough, then you can see if it applies within how Krishna gives things or how Prabhupada explains things or not. Until you can connect it into Prabhupada's thing, then it doesn't, it won't really give a solution.
So it means that it just take the dry thing and try to do something, but they don't really connect.
Yeah, because they're not, there's, the culture is missing. The philosophy is missing and the culture is missing, so you don't get either. So, because one you'll get sentiment, one you get speculation, you know? So they're taking, you know, so they're missing the whole thing. So it's, they're trying to take it and apply it in the philosophy, but without the culture. You know, these outside books don't have the culture. They're applying according to Western values. Or the Indian ones are applying it without, with Indian values, but without philosophy. Or if they're giving a philosophy, it's impersonal. So you have to have Vaishnava philosophy and Vaishnava culture. And then you add material knowledge into that, then it gets you somewhere. Otherwise, how it will get us anywhere? Because without culture, how do you apply something? Culture is the art of application. Right? Just to know that if you pat Mr. Smith on the back at work and ask him how he's doing, then, you know, that's supposed to give you, that's supposed to make Mr. Smith work harder. So therefore, your only motive, you don't care for Mr. Smith at all. You only care that he works harder for you. So you're willing to go up and smile to him. And, you know, not caring for him, you're just asking about his family and how does he think things are going here, how can we improve the place, and he feels he's involved. So therefore, because he identifies with it, so he works harder because, you know, propriety turns sand into gold. All these different nice, you know, principles of human psychology. But it's simply for profit. So what kind of administration or management is that? What management, its goal is profit. Which varna? Understand? Brahminical? Kshatriya? Vaishya. Yeah, you understand? So all these systems and books that you read about on the market are Vaishya management. These aren't government management. This is not Kshatriya management. This is Vaishya management. All the examples are business. Everything's business. They're not talking about it. Maybe they take it down to the family level. Like that. You know, but just general family level, then that's, but on what principles is the family being based? Maybe there's some religious principles, maybe not. What's the purpose? Sense gratification. You know, there'll be a peaceful house, everything will work nicely. For what? So you're satisfied. So that's not on the religious platform. Though it may be quoting religious things, therefore it becomes sub-religious. Sub-religious again puts it in the realm of economics. The profit of peace, the profit of happiness. It may not be gross like money, but it's subtle. That's the profit that's being gained. So therefore, it's gross or subtle economic development. And economic development is not the purpose of Dharma. Not for devotees, maybe for karmis. For devotees, our Dharma is supposed to be used to liberate us from the material world. That's why devotees, they apply these, they don't work for them. And it doesn't even give proper artha. Because the point is there's a culture on how you deal with Mr. Smith. Just because you give a crocodile smile and shake his hand and pat him on the back doesn't mean that he's convinced. Maybe he was today, but will he be tomorrow? You know? It's a nice trick. You work, you use it. But if you use it every day, then it seems to be artificial. So you have to know the son. Why is it? Why do you care? It means you have to know about him as a person. You know, you're working with a guy, you want to know him. You're in charge of the place, and he's working for you. So it's a relationship. It's a rasa of master and servant. Right? Therefore, then you want to know about him. But as you know about him, then if he says he has problem and this and that, then as the master, you're obliged to help him. Right? Otherwise, where's the relationship? That's dharma. That will give artha. So it looks the same, it seems to be the same, but it's very different. Because one is actually dharma, and one is artha. You're working from artha to get artha, and you won't get it. Artha has to be based on dharma, it doesn't function. Does that make sense? That's the whole. That's the science. So dovetailing it means you have to know what the culture is. Therefore there's tradition. The tradition is there. We see in the Bhagavatam Chaitanya Charitamrita how the previous people, they performed activities. You know? They applied the philosophy in their life, and then they came up with, you know, what is there. Does that make sense? So that's the science. So that's why if you're going to get into all these things, then you have to know how to make it work. Otherwise, if you don't know how to make it work, it won't work. Like that. Maybe if you're very sincere, then Krishna will do. But then you're not taking it on its own. You're just saying, oh, hey, this is there. Maybe I'll try that. And then Krishna will show you how to make it work. But if you think, because I know this, now I can make everything work. I'm the big manager. It won't work. I don't know. Therefore also, even the Vedic stuff, you know, that's the new Maya, is all the Vedic, you know, sciences. They take that, but if they don't know how to make Vastu, or how to make the astrology, you know, work, it won't work for them. Because you have to know what is the foundation of this. Who is Vastu? He's a devotee. You know? So he's looking for the devotional aspect. That's the best. If you don't have that, then he's got all kinds of rules for you. You know, or feng shui. Now, what does feng shui got to do with anything? Right? Feng shui is Chinese. Where did the Chinese get it from? They got it from India. So unless you know how to connect it back, then what's there? Otherwise, it's material prosperity, but based on what level? What level is the prosperity? You know? But you have to be careful. What does that mean? What kind of prosperity are they looking for? Right? Well, what is the purpose? You yourself get some money, get a position, get something else, and that's all. So is that enough? Yeah. And at what expense? What is your consciousness? What's the level of the consciousness? What level are you working at? Dharma, artha, kama. It doesn't work at moksha, that's for sure. You know, so therefore what is the purpose behind it? So the farther away it gets, the more you have to be able to convert it into the Vedic. And once it's in the Vedic, you have to be able to convert that into the devotional. You know? So unless you know what is the devotional and all those things, and the science of how that goes down from the top down, then it'll be dangerous. You may get distracted, which many do. You know, oh, the astrology says this, that, and so many things. At the same time, Krishna says, when you don't care for auspicious or inauspicious, then you're getting somewhere spiritually. Right? At the same time, you quoted that Prabhupada, you know, in Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, we're careful about traveling at certain times and doing things according to auspicious things, simply because they wanted to get a good result for Krishna. For themselves, they don't care. Right? The material energy will just function like this. So therefore, if we go in at this point, then we'll get that result for Krishna. You know? So they're not caring about auspicious or inauspicious for themselves. But why are we reading our own chart? For ourselves or for others? Right? If it's how to better, okay, engage in this service, that, okay, better this or that, okay, then we just do that. But if, you know, we're looking at it, we're looking at, you know, when we're going to get money, when we're going to get this, when we're going to get so many things, when we're going to be healthy, when we're going to be sick, when we're gonna, but for what reason? Just for service? It is service, but it's Krishna is kind of second in the picture, rather than Krishna is first in the picture. Yeah. So it's been a tool, it may be a tool for increasing our material absorption and attachment. We're becoming conscious, yes, but of what? Our own situation, rather than our situation in connection with Krishna. It may be used for connecting us with fine. But astrology can't see spiritual things. The astrologers will say they can, but they can't. That's like saying with the material intelligence and everything, we'll understand God. We can't. Right? That's like saying with our eyes we're going to see, you know, infrared sound, and with our ears we're going to see these high frequency sounds that only dogs can hear. We can't. It's just, it's not possible. They can see up to the door of liberation, and that's the limit that they can see. They say, oh, very spiritual, but spiritual for them means liberation. Spiritual for some will mean religious. But there is no spiritual in astrology. Unless you connect that back to Krishna. You have to see Krishna's potencies, Krishna's. So it completely changes how you look at it. You can't look at it with material profit, gain and safety, and see it in connection with Krishna. You can't get both. You know? You can be in two boats at once. You can't do that. You can't be absorbed in Krishna and absorbed in Maya. It doesn't work. Maybe 50-50. But 50% is not good enough to go back to Godhead. We need 100%. You know, so therefore, it's a very delicate thing. It's used, but you have to know how it's used. Otherwise, if you don't know, don't use it. Otherwise, you get entangled by it. So like that means all these branches of knowledge are there. But unless one uses it properly, then there can be problems. Does that make some sense? Yeah. Anything else?
Rajanath, are the Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, and other like scriptures not sources of true knowledge? Babaji, the Bhagavad Gita has come from the mouth of the Supreme Lord Himself. It is also called the Gita Upanishad. It is counted as one of the Vedas, because they are the teachings of Lord Gauranga. The 10 verses of Dasamula are also one of the Vedas. The Srimad Bhagavatam is an anthology of the truths described in the Vedas. It is the crest jewel of all sources of knowledge. They confirm the Veda's teachings. The other Smriti Shastras are also sources of true knowledge. The Tantra Shastra of three kinds, one, those in the mode of goodness, those in passion, and those in ignorance. Among them, the Pancharatras and other Tantras in the mode of goodness expand the confidential portions of the Veda's teachings. The word Tantra comes from the verbal root tan, to expand. Therefore, these Tantras are also counted amongst the sources of true knowledge. Because before he had mentioned the Shruti and this and that, they have to, and they're only useful if they confirm the teachings of the Vedas. So then, of this, then Gita is the essence, because it's come from the Supreme Lord. It's the Gita Upanishad. The Upanishads give the essence of the Veda. It means the Veda is there, then the ritualistic aspects of it, the esoteric meanings of those rituals, and other, you know, rules like that. Are there, but the conclusion is given in the Upanishads, you know, that how we're supposed to get out of this material, not how to stay in this material.
So then the Gita is Upanishad. So it's the essence of the Upanishads. So the Vedas are the essence of the the Upanishad is the essence of the Veda. The Gita is the essence of the Upanishads. Like that. Vedanta Sutra is the essence of the Vedas also, and Upanishads. And the Bhagavatam is then the commentary, natural commentary on that. So it gives, Rudra says, an anthology of all the truths that the Vedas are trying to establish. The Bhagavatam gives those all in the perfect way. Then the Dasamul, Lord Chaitanya then gives that as the essence of all this. This is what everything is based on. These ten truths are what the Vedas speak about. So if these ten truths are understood, then you understand the Vedas. Otherwise, you don't understand the Vedas. You won't be able to understand. Like that. And the Pancharatras, then they are giving all the various rules and regulations. Like that. The tantras mean to expand. They take into points to show how it expands, how it applies in the world. So then you have the ones in the mode of goodness, the ones in the mode of passion, and the ones in the mode of ignorance. So the Pancharatras, those tantras, those are in the mode of goodness. And then you have so many others that are in the mode of passion and ignorance. Like that. You know, it's like upasana means you worship the demigods, that's in the mode of passion. Because you want so many benefits, or a worship of Devi and Shiva, they'll be worshiping the mode of ignorance. Or because you're worshiping ghosts and other things like this. But the Pancharatras, those mantras, those tantras, those rituals, then they expand the Veda into the practical life, into our practical application. Like that. So, that makes sense. Yeah. Rajanath, the Vedas consist of many different books. Among them, which should be accepted and which should not? Please tell me. Babaji, in the course of time, certain unscrupulous men interpolated many new chapters, mandalas, and mantras in the text of the Vedas. Therefore, it is not that all the parts of the Vedas should be accepted. What in the course of time the acharyas in the bona fide disciplic succession have accepted, that should be considered the actual Veda. What they have rejected as interpolations should not be accepted. So that's how we understand what's interpolated or not. Otherwise, also the modern scholars would say so many things are interpolated. You know, they can't understand why would in the laws of Manu, then the first chapter is all on creation. So they'll say that's interpolated, that was put in. They don't understand, but the body of knowledge itself has to be connected to the Lord. So therefore you have to start with the Lord, then come into creation, then come down to what the body of knowledge deals with. Each of the branches starts like that. Ayurveda also starts with creation. They all start with creation. And then only, like in the grammar, like in Jiva Goswami's grammar, the first verse says, Narayanadu Bhuto Yam Varna Kamaha, but the letters of the Sanskrit alphabet have expanded from Narayan. So the connection is already there to Narayan. And so that's always the first thing. That's always the first point, is that the Vedic scriptures always connect everything to the Lord, but the modern academics will say that's interpolation. They don't understand. If it doesn't make sense to their brain, then they'll say it's interpolated. It doesn't make, or it was done at a later date, or all these different things. So they come up with very strange ideas of what's going on. So therefore, what is interpolated, what is not, that we have to turn to the acharyas, because the Lord has manifest within their heart and has manifested true knowledge through them. Therefore, they establish what is real and what is to be rejected. Like that. And so if we stick to that, then that viewpoint will be perfect. Even if from one acharya to the other is different, if that's our line, then by following that, like the Shris, they won't go near demigods. They won't go into the temple, they won't deal with them, they won't bow down to them, they won't do nothing with them. But the Madhvas do. the Madhvas will worship demigods instead, but as devotees of the Lord. Like that. The different potencies of the Lord. That's how they see it. God's potency to rule is Indra. God's potency to nourish is Varuna. God's potency as fire is Agni. God's potency. So they don't see the demigod, they see the person, they see the potency. Right? But the Shris don't even deal with that. They're just, why? Potencies are all there in Vishnu, so what do we need to deal with them? Both are correct. You know? In our Gaudiya Vaishnavas, we see the potency, we see the person. But we see how that potency has come from the Lord, and then that Lord is the source of all those potencies, so through that we just go back to the Lord. So seeing the demigod, that reminds us of the Lord, so we just think of the Lord. So we actually do what both of them do, simultaneously. They do one or the other, we do both simultaneously. So it takes us to the Lord, you know, but like this. So you follow one, it works. But you have to follow your own acharyas. You can't mix and match.
Since you mentioned demigods, when I was reading Mahabharata, there's something that's confusing me sometimes. Maybe I'm not supposed to read that. But it happened several times that Pandavas, they turn to demigods for... they're not Vishnu Supreme Lord. They turn, when they were going to this last year of exile, I believe. And so Yudhishthira was praying to Maya, Durgadevi, to protect them so that nobody recognizes them. Or once also, he was asking his priest what to do, and he said he went to Sun God for, I don't remember what it was.
The path. At Akshay Path.
Yeah. It just made me think, what are we, because we're supposed to learn from these creatures. And that really wants to Krishna, and they know Krishna is the Lord and everything. So, how do we look at this, and what is supposed to learn from this?
That's why the Bhagavatam has been written. So you can, if you approach Mahabharata from the understanding of the Bhagavatam, then you can apply it. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, basically Mahabharata is establishing religious principles, Dharma. That's what it's establishing. So that's why Vyasadeva wasn't completely satisfied. Because it didn't give the conclusions. Conclusion is given, but it's hidden. It's not direct. So then, you know, people will follow this and stay very happily in the material world. To go back to Godhead, then you have to approach through the Bhagavatam. Therefore you see the Pandava stories are told in the Bhagavatam. Those things are left out. Okay, now why Maya? Maya does what? What does Maya do in this world to living entities? Yeah, covers them. And so do they see what's right and what's correct or not? Do they see, you know, what's the reality? No, okay. So then she's the one they approach that they will be successful in their identity being covered. Right? So that potency is there. But they're seeing it from that point. And they're not just playing to her, just help us, and they're an illusion. They understand that she's been empowered with the Lord's potency to cover people, so therefore, may she be kind upon us. As the Lord's devotee, having that potency of the Lord, that then we may be able to not be, so we can accomplish our service for Krishna. You understand? So there's a completely different platform of knowledge, but that's not explained in the Mahabharata. This is not meant for that level. That will be understood from Bhagavatam. The sun is what provides. The sun nourishes, everything grows because of that. So all food happens because of the sun. You perform yajna, then that goes to the sun. The sun then evaporates the water. The water creates the clouds create the rain creates the grains. Right? So the grains create the semen creates the new children. So the whole cycle is going because of this, of the sun. So, therefore, if you want to feed everybody, then the sun is the one that's approached. And that's one way of doing it. You could also approach Annapurna, because she is material energy, she's everybody's mother, and she's nourishing everybody. Therefore, you could also feed through that. It's just which mood you want to go through. You know,
Because when I was reading it, I was thinking that because Pandavas are aware of everything, and they know we're the servants of the large ones, like you said, we're doing specific things in the universe. So instead of like kind of asking Krishna for every little thing, they know who is in charge for this kind of material things, and then they ask them.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're trying to understand me.
But the point is what is Bhagavatam saying? You understand? Does Bhagavatam say approach the demigods? Yeah, so therefore you read the Mahabharata through the understanding of the Bhagavatam. That's our book. Our book's Bhagavatam, not Mahabharata. It's itihas, so it's in support of Bhagavatam. So what's in line with that, then we take. What's not in line with that's not for us. Just like you go into a medicine shop. It's full of medicine. But you have a prescription. And you give that to the person, and they take out what of all those medicines what you need and give you that. And if you say, well, hey, what's that over there? I like a nice green box and all that, and nice writing on it. Give me some of that. But that's not for you. That's for someone else on a lower level. That's elevating them. Right? A person who would just do things on his own, by his own strength, then he needs to understand that it's not by your own strength. It's by the demigods are running everything. So therefore you have to approach them. Oh, okay. Then they approach them. And once they understand the demigods, but the demigods, where do they get their power from? That comes from the Supreme Lord. You know, so therefore if you approach the Supreme Lord, then all the benefits given by the demigods is taken care of. So that's what the Bhagavatam is. So the Mahabharata is for those who are below following the rules and regulations, that they will follow them. But once who are following them, then they should know why are they following them? Who has given them? That's come from the Lord. Like these, the Vedas says, okay, everybody who follows the Vedas will agree with that, but where did the Vedas come from? You know, that's the point. So then, since the Vedas are important, then you follow the Vedas, that takes us back to the next stage. That makes sense. Okay. So therefore, what doesn't make sense between the Mahabharata and the Bhagavatam, you take the Bhagavatam. Like that. You want to know about Pandavas, you read those chapters on the Pandavas in the first canto. Right? Then that makes sense. Like that. Then, with that, then if you want to read the Mahabharata, then you can understand what's important for them. There's the other things, they're just duties that they do. It's part of the culture, they just do it. But they're living in that Vedic age. Now we're living in Lord Chaitanya's time, so many things have been cleared out by the Kali Yuga, they just don't follow, so we don't have to worry about it. And Lord Chaitanya's then established that these are the essential points of the Vedas you must follow. Right? Because others have followed so many things, and then there's the few points that are essential. So for us, all that's been cleared out, all that's left of the essential points, basically. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah, just one more thing. Sometimes they say, like, I know when I joined, when I was in the temple, so sometimes they say, oh, pray to Hanuman, you know, for this or something. Like, you know, you lose something, you should pray to Hanuman. It's like, I don't know, it's kind of thing like that. Or, like, sometimes they say, pray to, I don't know, some devotee who is also considered a demigod, I mean, they're all devotees, to remove obstacles in the sense like that. So, how do you do that?
I don't know, at least when I joined the temple, they didn't tell me those things. So probably could be, if you have to see what is there, but it's also a possibility just people are reading too many books. Mm-hmm. And then they're applying these things without knowing, you know. Because obstacles are removed by Ganesh. Ganesh keeps Nrisimhadeva's feet on his head so he can remove those obstacles. So you pray to Nrisimhadeva, then obstacles are removed. You know, pray to any other guru. The guru is the sum total of all the demigods. You pray to him, you don't need to pray to any other demigod. And the potencies of the demigods are from the Supreme Lord, so you pray to him. So we don't bother with those things. Because if you approach Hanuman as a devotee, that's one thing. But then, why Hanuman? You could approach any devotee. If you're approaching him as Hanuman as a demigod, then technically you have to approach all of them, because they're all, 33 million are counted as one entity. The potencies of the Lord are 33 million.
manifest in this world. So unless you recognize all of them, then you insult the others. That's the weak point in approaching the demigods as demigods. Is if you approach one and neglect the other, you're actually, then they get upset. So you have to be able to worship all 33 million. If you can't do that, then don't bother. That's why they're not really successful. That's why it's easier, you approach the Lord, who's the source of those 33 million potencies, and they're all in one place, so you can worship the Supreme Lord, and they won't be disturbed. Like that. So why are they approaching Hanuman? As a devotee? But then why him? No, why not? We already have our own. That means our line, we have our own. But if you were a worshiper of Ramachandra, then you would approach Hanuman. In a sense that depending upon who you're worshipping, they have their group of associates, and so therefore then if you're worshipping Vishnu, then you would approach Vishvakshena, because he's the main person. For us, we have our acharyas. Does that make sense? If you're a Madhva, then Hanuman's important, because Madhva is Hanuman, he is Vayu. Yeah. See, it's whoever is a dear devotee, they're the ones removing the obstacles. For us, that's the Goswamis. That's our own acharyas. Right? So they're the direct. It means the Lord, Vishvakshena, demigods, Ganesh is the name. You know, for those who the Vedic culture, then it's Ganesh. Those who are Vishnu worshippers, then it'll be Vishvakshena. Those who are Ramachandra worshippers, it'll be Hanuman. You know, those who worship Radha and Krishna, then that'll be the Goswami, our Goswami. You know, because that's our line. So it's going to be whoever is intimate with the Lord, because the Lord is the one that removes them. So if you please that devotee, they will recommend our case to the Lord, and because it's come from them, then he'll be pleased to remove it. Does that make sense? Like that. So the principle is there, but you have to know how to apply the principle for us. That's the point. So the principle is there. But they're following the Vedic culture because that's what Krishna is doing, his pastime. They're part of that pastime. Krishna coming and following the Vedic culture. So therefore they do those things. Depends what you're trying to remove. Isn't it? If you're trying to remove the problem of your next door neighbor or something like that, you know, then we don't. But if you're trying to understand the fine points of devotional service, then we're approaching it. You know, at the same time, as that's dependent upon Nityananda's mercy. Because if he's merciful upon us, then we can give up our attachments to this world. Then we can follow their instructions. So it's all together, simultaneously one and different. Means they're all happening at once. The other lines, you do this, you do that, you do... That's why they're simpler. Ours is very complex because of this dual thing happening at once. Contradictory activities are happening at once because we're getting closer. You understand? Vishnu, I am God. I am the Lord. Right? But Krishna, is he God? Is he the Lord? Right? You understand? So, but he is the Lord. He is the source of everybody. Means Vishnu considers him their Lord. Balaram considers Krishna his Lord. Everybody considers him the Lord, but at the same time, he doesn't consider that I am the Lord. I'm son of Maharaj, you know, Mother Yashoda, Maharaj Nanda, you know, Radharani, the gopis are his girlfriends, Sri Dham Sudham are his friends, you know, and like that, Dhanishta and others are his, and Raktak are his confidential servitors, like that, he has his cows. So these are contradictory. So when you get back to the origin, everything's in him. So naturally, whatever there is in creation, because as it expands, there's going to be something here doesn't match with something there. But when you get back to the source, they match. So that's the difficulty. We're trying to look here and look down here, but the answer is not down here, the answer is up there. That's why unless you can take this all the way back, you can't understand what this is. So when you can take this back, then you can understand this, then you can see how they're not contradictory. Does that make sense? Because we're trying to make things fit this way. You can only make it fit this way if you understand the connection of Krishna. That's why you have great scholars, you know, of the Vedic culture, but they don't understand what's going on. Because they can't take it back. So they can't understand the essence. So that's what Gita Bhagavatam does. It shows the essence. Then you approach these other scriptures. Otherwise, people will get confused. They'll get confused. Is that okay? No. And what obstacles are removing? If you approach Hanuman, then what will remove? You know what I'm saying? For what? Removing what? You know, the hinge on my door is rusty, or you know what I'm saying? Well, the really main thing is he has all kinds of nice qualities of service to us, his Lord. So his current, you know, his being determined, his ability to, you know, do anything, these are valuable. Let me approach him as a devotee to that he has all these wonderful qualities that we may also develop. You know, so that's not a problem. That way you can approach. But just to remove the obstacles, why him? You know. Does that make sense? Then it's pointed out then. Nithi Dhamma is the most merciful. Does that make sense? So someone has to be careful as devotees take these because they're new. Anything different is looks good, you know. That's the point.
It's like a new wave now. I see people.
Yeah, but that's different. Before there would be pictures of Hanuman, like you always had the picture of Hanuman carrying the mountain. But that's it's showing his devotion to the Lord. He'll get the work done, doesn't matter what. That's what he does, is he moves opposite, it doesn't matter. But it's devotion. So therefore, we need the devotion to overcome. Because of his devotion, he goes to the mountain. He knows the herd is there. He's going to pick the mountain. He's going to pick those herds. The sages don't want him to take the herds. So therefore they create an illusion because those herds sparkle. They're effulgent. So they make every plant on the hill effulgent. So he can't tell which is which. So because he has to get the herd to there, otherwise Lakshman will die, he just picks up the mountain. Because he's able to. So he finds a solution. And then he brings back the mountain. So that the removal is because of his devotion to the Lord. So therefore, rather than pray to him to remove the obstacle, so what? Okay, remove the obstacle. Then it's better to have that devotion he has to serve the Lord. That would be better. Then we don't care for the obstacle, right? The obstacle automatically goes away. Or even if it's there, who cares? It's not an obstacle. Because the point is we want to remember Krishna. We're not trying to find perfection in this world. Right? So we remove an obstacle to create a material perfection. But that's not the goal. The goal is the devotion. We're using that service as a medium to serve the Lord. Whether it becomes materially perfect or not doesn't matter. That doesn't matter. But that's what we know, that's what we do, we try to make it the best we can.
So to have a picture of Hanuman and Ganesh on the wall because he's going to remove our obstacles, that's not seeing the best in them. To see their devotional qualities and their surrender to the Lord, that is proper understanding. Like that. So therefore, one has to be very careful of what is there. The devotion, like Prahlad Maharaj, we take from him that surrender, that dedication to Guru, that faith in the Lord, you know, undeviating, is fixed, being fixed in the Lord's service, like that. We take those things from him, you know. Not that taking that the supreme form that we worship as our istadeva, this is Nishimidev. No. We're worshipping Krishna, who is called as Nishimidev. And his devotee is Prahlad, so therefore we can learn from Prahlad pure devotional service. Like that. That's the thing. We're trying to get to pure devotional service, so we take his example. We don't pray to Prahlad to, you know, there's an elephant about to step on us, so elephants didn't step on him, so please, you know, don't let this elephant step on me. You know, let me be fixed in service to the Lord and faith in the Lord like you are, so that no matter what happens, then, you know, elephant steps on me or doesn't step on me, and that's, you know. Prahlad wasn't praying to the Lord, don't let this elephant step on me, or don't let these snakes bite me, or don't let this cold freeze me. He was just chanting, absorbed in serving the Lord. And whether the elephant steps on him or not, or the snakes bite him or not, or he freezes or not, that's up to the Lord. He'll remember the Lord, whatever happens. He gets stepped on, he goes back to Godhead. And he's remembering the Lord. So he's just doing that. And if the Lord wants to save him or not, that's up to the Lord. What's better? The Lord saves you and you sit here more in the material world, or he takes you back to Godhead. Right? So if you can stay here and expand the preaching and benefit others, then great. But if you're just staying here because you don't want to die, what's the use? So it all depends upon your values. You know, who are you for servant of the Lord? So that should then flavor everything else that we deal with. Does that make sense? Okay. Is everything else should be seen in relation to that. How does removing this obstacle, how does that benefit us? What is the benefit of it? The benefit is there, is that the obstacle actually is our lack of Krishna consciousness. That's the real obstacle. We're not seeing Krishna in this. Otherwise, we wouldn't see it as an obstacle. Right? Were the Pandavas praying to Krishna to get us out of the forest? No, they were praying that they may remember Krishna. They may be absorbed in Krishna. Right? The forest is not the problem. The problem is lack of Krishna consciousness. Like Bhaktisiddhanta says, that Thakur said, there's no shortage of anything in this world except Krishna consciousness. Everything else is here in plenty. You know, whatever you would want, it's here in this world. Whether you get it or not, it's another thing. Plenty, everything's here. But what's lacking here is Krishna consciousness. That's what's missing. Is that okay? Anything else on these points? Otherwise, yeah. Okay, so we're into it. Jai Shri Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivinoda ki, Jai Nityananda Gaura Premananda.